Castello Aragonese.
Andare.
I'm actually going there now to the castle.
You speak English now?
Yeah. Why, do you think I was Italian? I came out here with this organization dedicated to studying the relic populations of dolphins and whales.
I can't tell if you're joking.
I'm dead serious.
Are you following me?
Maybe. Is that weird? Hey.
Oh my God. Oh. That's my husband.
What does he do?
He is playing in a concert at the end of the month. You're home early.
Jerry, I'm sorry. Just give me a minute.
People are depending on me. I've committed myself.
You know, when you were 19, and carefree and full of possibility, you reminded me of that. Are you listening?
You make me feel nervous.
You make me feel calm.
That story about the red string. We're all connected by this red string. Someone you bump into on the street, destined to be your soulmate.
Hello and welcome back to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. For this episode, we are discussing the film And While We Were Here. And While We Were Here is a 2012 drama starring Kate Bosworth as Jane, an unhappily married woman on a work vacation on the island of Ischia, Italy, with her musician husband, Leonard, Itto Goldberg. While Leonard is consumed by his work, Jane listens to tapes she has recorded with her grandmother, discussing her life during World War II, for a book she is working on. While touring the island, Jane meets Caleb, a much younger man whose freewheeling ways draw Jane out of her shell. When they begin to grow closer, Jane and Leonard's marriage starts to unravel, leaving Jane with a decision about her life. Joining me to discuss And While We Were Here are the film's writer-director, Kat Coiro, and its cinematographer, Doug Chamberlain. Hello.
Hi.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you both for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
We're so excited to be here and take this trip down memory lane. It's been a while.
I love talking to people who make movies. I love getting into the background of it, the nuts and bolts of how you make a movie. I always find it utterly fascinating. So excited. I am just so excited to talk to two of the people who made this movie. This is just so exciting. So let's just start right at the top. Kat, what was the inspiration for And While We Were Here?
Well, there were a lot of inspirations. I had just finished my first film, which was a little friendship rom-com called Life Happens, that also starred Kate Bosworth. And Kate was like, let's do something again. And when somebody like Kate says that, you immediately decide that you're going to make something for her because she's just such a luminous, beautiful actress. And you know, we wanted to make something low budget, something where we had complete creative control. And so we looked at all these mumblecore films that were being made, some of which, we really enjoyed. But there was a theme. They were all kind of set in East Los Angeles. They all were set in little rooms. They didn't have a visual flair. So we decided, with the help of our producer, Lauren Bratman, who's had family on the island of Ischia, that we wanted to make something in the low budget, micro budget, mumblecore style, but with a gorgeous backdrop. Our joke was, if nothing else, it'll be beautiful. And then the second part of the inspiration was I had, right before my grandmother passed away in 2006, I had spent a couple weeks with her recording her. And I had all these tapes of her talking about her life. And my original intention was to write some kind of biography. And the truth was, her stories were very small and simple and didn't really lend themselves to a big narrative. And so they'd been sitting in a box in my room for, at that point, almost 6 years. And so I really wanted to use them. So they ended up becoming a big part of the story, reworded and re-narrated by Claire Bloom, but definitely with a lot of flavor of my grandmother's life.
I think there was another inspiration that I felt like was in there, and that's Leonard Cohen's song, Famous Blue Raincoat, that
yes.
I felt like, I know once you introduced that to me as part of the inspiration for the film, I drew a lot of my own inspiration from just listening to that and the tone and the feel of that song.
Yeah, that's so true. I see, it's been a long time, Rob. I completely forgot about that. So Famous Blue Raincoat, if you're not familiar with it, is a Leonard Cohen song that has this kind of love triangle in it. But it's very nebulous and enigmatic. And I'd always listened to it and wondered what he was talking about. What was the story? So in a way, this, you know, that element of the film, the relationship between Jane, Leonard, and Caleb was kind of an answer to what that song means. And I actually have a very fun Leonard Cohen story that I'll tell you about later in the process.
Okay. So you mentioned Kate Bosworth saying, hey, let's do something again. I have not seen the other film, Life Happens, but it's like a rom-com. When you approached her with this, what do you remember what her original reaction was? That this was so different from what you had done previously with her?
Well, she was a huge part of the inception of this film. So it wasn't like she said, you know, I went away and wrote something. She said, let's do something together. She really wanted to explore this idea of betrayal. That was something that she was really interested in. And she was just turning 30 at the time. And we had a lot of conversations about, you know, 30 is obviously still very young, but it is a milestone. And it is a time where you start to, you know, knock on the door of getting a little older. And, you know, now 10 years later, that seems ridiculous. So young. But at the time, you know, it was something that she really wanted to explore. So we would discuss what themes we wanted to touch on. I would go off and write and come back and she would give notes. So it was a very collaborative process. Between all of us, really, we were such a small group. It was, you know, me and Kate and then Doug and then our producer, Lauren Bratman, and our editor, who is also our on-set sound mixer, Adam Catino. And that was really it. So it was very, very collaborative in a way that normal films aren't.
Yeah, we had moments where we were over at Kate's place and like going through her own wardrobe, deciding mm-hmm. what she's going to wear on this. And it was like the entire crew was there.
Yeah, the entire crew
was there. Standing in her closet.
And she, you know, she really put together all the ensembles for the film, which is, you know, we didn't have a costume designer. It was really her and her clothing. And I think she did a pretty remarkable job.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she's in every scene in the movie. I mean, to my recollection, there's not a single scene without her.
No.
Right. No. It's all from her point of view. Every character that we meet is through her. Doug, how did you get involved in this?
Well, I had done that Cat's first film with her. And so we were just, this was just overflowing from that first film, really. And so we enjoyed working together and we wanted to continue to work together. And so we just kept on going. And so this seemed like a fun little project. You know, the mumblecore thing was I was really into that part of it. This idea of doing something, you know, can you make something really small and yet make it beautiful? And ultimately, I don't feel like we made a mumblecore film. And I don't even know if that was the point of it, but it was the exciting part about it. It was, you have to keep in mind that there was a revolution that was going on with cameras at this time where the 5D had come out and everybody was shooting these tiny little micro projects on the 5D and they were getting into Sundance. And so that was kind of the background of what had been going on for maybe 4 or 5 years with these really small films. But So it was just kind of an opportunity to jump out and to do that and have complete creative control.
Yeah. And there was no, there, like I said, there was no crew. It was Doug and a camera. We had one China bowl that we bought in the IKEA Naples. Mm-hmm. And we would really just go around and shoot wherever the light was beautiful. And, you know, we had a plan, but we also deviated from that plan depending on what would look nice.
And when we went out and scouted everything, it was just like, this would be a right time of day to shoot this. And so mm-hmm. sometimes we'd get up at like 5 a.m. and we'd go out and we'd shoot. And then we would take like 4 hours off in the middle of the day when we didn't really have like a great place to shoot. And so it was a lot of that kind of stuff. But yeah, and we were pulling our own focus. We did have two cameras there, and even I think Itto shot some stuff for us. Itto shot us some stuff, and I think Lauren, the producer, shot some stuff. And then, you know, we had a couple of extra people would pick up the second camera and help out on shots when we were doing shot reverse shot coverage and things like that. And Itto is actually a really wonderful photographer. I've kept up with him over the years, and he's really got a great eye.
Doug, I do want to ask you, how did you get into cinematography? I'm always fascinated how people get into certain specific jobs in the filmmaking business.
Mine started at a pretty young age. I was in middle school when I really started getting into photography. And I had a friend of mine whose father was a professional, like fine art photographer. And so my interest started there, and I did, you know, yearbook and newspaper for the school and things like that. And then it just got to the point of trying to figure out what I wanted to do with photography. And ultimately I felt like this idea of traveling the world and shooting stills for, you know, in your high school imagination, like what you're going to do is you're going to work for National Geographic and just take photos all over the world. But the reality is that there's not that many of those jobs available. And so anyways, but my natural interest took me to cinematography. So ultimately I graduated from AFI and started there, and had really good friends who got going in commercial world. And so that's where a lot of my career has taken place, is in the commercial world, and then keep jumping back and forth into the narrative.
Gotcha. I do want to, for people who don't know the background to this movie, I do want to set the stage a little bit about how it was made. You talked about the simplicity of it. You shot it in what, 11 days? Is that right?
Yep. 11 days.
And for like $200,000?
$150,000.
I mean, how does that happen? How do you possibly get all that done and for that kind of money? I mean, that they can't make commercials for that kind of money.
No.
Well, you know, we like I said, there was a little core group of us, and we were all very dedicated to making it work, and we all wore many hats, and, you know, nobody really got paid except for the SAG, you know, union dues that were required. We put people up and bought pizza. That's where the money went. It's true. It really is. It's like to fly everybody out there, feed everybody, and house everybody was kind of the majority of the budget. So the rest was just the labor of love, really.
And you had to have somebody like Kate who was into it, right?
Yeah.
Like, so she had to be the one that had to be a champion of this. And then that brought, I think that helped bring the other actors.
Oh, for sure. You know, Itto was an old friend of Kate's, mm-hmm. and we wrote that role with him in mind. I had lunch with the two of them and got to know, you know, his sensibility. And then we reached out to Jamie, who we didn't know, but who was really excited to work with Kate. And he was such a wonderful presence when Jamie Blackley came to town. We were all very happy. And so we had three actors who were just really gung-ho, and every other person who appears in the film is just somebody from the streets. Of,
right.
I don't think we can understate like the power of Giuseppe and
yes.
Daniela.
Yes.
There was
Well, let's go back to Lauren. So our producer, Lauren Bratman, who also worked on While We Were Here, who is a longtime collaborator of mine, you know, she really put everything together and helped secure the financing and managed our tiny budget. And her husband, Anthony, has this big extended family in Ischia. And so, yes, we kind of landed and didn't have a lot of resources, but we had a lot of support from this group of local people on the island. And I have a cousin who lives in Naples who helped us out. So it was really a family affair.
That's really handy.
Yes. And that's part of why we chose to shoot there. It's very beautiful, but we also had a built-in support system.
I would imagine on the producing side of it, when you've only got 150 grand to spend, that's a Herculean task, because every dollar has got to be really effectively dispatched, as opposed to, you know, you're making some other thing for 200 million. You can just throw money at the problem. If you have a problem, just another, we can afford that. But when you've got 150 grand to spend to shoot over an entire movie, you're really looking at every single penny. That's got to be an amazing task for a producer.
Yeah. And it makes you very economical as a filmmaker. You know, we did shot lists. We planned everything, to down to the T, and then we had to stick to it. We knew we had certain parameters. Are there concessions we had to make? Are there things we wish we would have done differently? Yes, but I think that's always the case. Mm-hmm. And we felt pretty excited by what we got in our 11 days. It's hard to imagine.
I remember when we first landed, and it was like we just started to roam the island looking for these locations, you know, because we didn't have
We did Google Maps before we went and picked general locations.
And we have put together, Kat and I had put together a document for inspiration of things that we liked, just images that felt indicative of the film that we were trying to make. And so that actually helped out a lot, because then we were on location and we were kind of searching for those types of things. And so things mm-hmm. would stand out to us. That we were like, oh, this reminds us of our kind of mood board that we had set. But, you know, there were some criteria there of where we're going to be able to steal that location mm-hmm. once we found it. And so we got really lucky. The castle, Aragonese, mm-hmm. after 3 or 4 days of being there, maybe it was 3 days that we shot there, they knew what we were doing, and they didn't bother us at all. They just let us.
Yeah, we bought our tickets as tourists.
Yeah.
And then we went into the castle and shot and hoped nobody would. We never really got kicked out of anywhere.
No, they knew. After a while, they kind of knew what we were doing there, and they kind of welcomed us. And that kind of became the theme. It was like restaurants that we were shooting at. They seemed to kind of open their arms to us.
You know, there's a scene where the restaurateur, when they, you know, comes out and yells at them in a Neapolitan dialect. And, you know, that was the real guy who ran the restaurant, and we were like, can you just come out and yell what you would yell if two people ran away without paying the bill? And he loved it. He was fantastic.
I wanted to ask you about that. How do you prep shots that are stolen like that? I mean, do you have to keep people from wandering into the frame? And I mean, was that something that just wasn't much of a concern considering where you were?
Yeah, we embraced that. You know, she is a tourist on the island of Ischia. So anybody who happened to wander into the frame, we were fine with that. Part of the motivation, there were many motivations for shooting it in black and white, but one of those, you know, was Doug's instinct that all the bright touristy colors, of random people that we can't control could be muted, and we could focus on the faces of our actors by shooting it black and white. And even in the released version that is in color, it's still muted, so that those backgrounds, while beautiful, become less the focal point. Because that is one thing you can't control, is the person in the deep background in the bright orange.
Yeah, sunlight. And at night, we were shooting available light, so it was like we didn't have control of the street lamps or anything like that. So it gave us... It gave us the look that we were really in control of everything, but we had to kind of embrace the chaos of the area.
So, I mean, then again, this is something for both of you, obviously. This movie is part of a sort of a cinematic tradition of like the travel film, where as much as it is about the story, it's about the location. You've got the sunrise, the before movies, the before trilogy. Lost in Translation or The Trip or Summertime with Katharine Hepburn, which is one of my favorites. For either one of you, was there a particular cinematic inspiration that were in the back of your mind? And obviously for you, Doug, the visuals, but for you, Kat, like those kinds of movies that were on your mind as you were getting ready to do this and or as you were doing it?
You know, I have, you know, one of the things I kept looking at, one of my favorite films is Luc Besson's The Big Blue. And I remember seeing that when I was young and in, you know, even before film school. And it was one of those, just that very first sequence in The Big Blue. I don't know if you've ever seen this movie. It's all in black and white, and it takes place in Greece, and it's like this moment where this guy is like growing up. And anyways, I love that sequence, and it was one of the most inspiring sequences for me, all done in black and white. And that was a big one for me of what I wanted to create, or the mood and the feeling I wanted to create. And I think we got there a few times, especially in the montage sequences and things like that. So that's where I was coming from. Personally. And then I know that we looked at Manhattan, and then we had looked at some old like Italian films and some French films and stuff like this. We wanted it to have that kind of pacing to it. But Kat.
Yeah. We embraced, you know, we liked the slowness of like the Antonioni films and that era of French and Italian cinema that's not afraid of silence.
Yeah.
Right. You have to let let it play out, you know, and doesn't have to kind of be filled with something going on, kind of languid. I mean, I noticed the film is, for a film that's so intimate, it features a lot of amazing like panoramic shots. And again, part of it is you want to get the island because it is so beautiful, but it has a kind of like epic sort of feel to it because you're getting these shots of these actors in the center of the frame or off to the right with these huge vistas behind them. And it's, you know, really gorgeous. I mean, it makes you want to go to Ischia.
Yay.
Yeah.
Because that really was, you know, that really was something we talked about a lot, was just like, how can we make something small and simple and intimate and doable on this very, very small budget that still is visually interesting and exciting and brings the viewer to another world.
Doug, was there any way you could light any given scene if you're stealing most of it? I mean, do you have lights that you can set up, or are you working entirely with just what's there?
It was a lot of natural light. Now, I would say 99% of this film was all just natural light. So, and this was a conversation that we had early on, is that, you know, you can shoot natural light if you shoot at the right time of day and make good decisions about where you place the camera and the angles that you choose. And so that's what we tried to do. And to everybody's credit, I felt very supported in that, as they really let me kind of dictate what time of day I wanted to shoot which locations. And it was fun. The castle was kind of our saving grace, because we could go in there in the middle of the day. And so that's why we kept returning to it, is we kept going back to that castle and shooting. When the light wasn't great for any of our other locations, we'd go back in there and shoot a little bit. Like I said, we bought that one china ball at IKEA and then used it in his like little downstairs basement apartment. Yeah. That was the only time we used it.
Yeah, when they have their kissing scene, we have the china ball. And that was really it, huh?
That was it. That's all he used.
You know, the hardest location was the train station, because it was a real train station, and we were just there waiting for the train to come at the right moment, and then the actors would get onto the train and take a stop, get back on the one coming back, and we'd do another take, and it was really, really challenging. There was music playing in the station, and we were just at the mercy of the train schedule, the Italian train schedule.
I was going to ask whether you had the ability to ask the trains to come at a certain point, but no, you didn't. You just had to have Kate stand on the platform and just wait.
Yeah, that was really tough. That was, I would say, looking back, the toughest moment, because sometimes there'd be big gaps and when the trains were there and we didn't have anything else to shoot in the train station. And it was a really emotional moment for both the actors. But again, this is what you can get away with just a camera, because that's it. It was a camera and our bodies.
And there was, I went back and watched this again just recently to kind of refresh myself because it's been a number of years. But looking at Itto's performance on that platform, it was like stunning. Like the what we were able to get and his ability to stay in it despite all those, like the yelling and like the panic when the train comes and like all the things that were going on and if we were on the right or wrong side of the platform. And his performances is really wonderful.
It's true. There was a little tunnel and we would run underneath and be like, oh no, the train's coming on this side. Go to that side. And he had a focus, but that's part of Itto's appeal, is that like steadfast, patient, grounded focus.
Yeah.
And he really delivered, because that was not easy for any of the actors, that train station.
And then there was the guy in the bathroom.
We'll leave it at that.
There were some inappropriate things happening in the bathroom
yes.
that became part of the conversation.
The train station was very colorful.
Very colorful, not in control.
Yes.
So, okay, I do want to talk about the cast a little bit, but before we get to that, I do want to ask both of you something else related. Like, have either one of you ever been on like a really bad vacation where obviously everyone goes on vacation and you know, I'm going to have a good time. That's the expectation. I've taken time off from work. I've spent money. I've arranged things. I'm going to have a good time. And then it just didn't. And the reason I'm even asking that is because in the opening scene with Kate and Itto, like you can tell right from the very beginning, they're just not in a good place.
Yeah.
And it's awkward as hell. And you know, I've been there. I've been on a vacation where I was so expecting to have a good time, and I'm like, oh no. And it's bad enough having that experience in your regular life, but then when you're at a place where presumably you're supposed to be kind of happy because you're on vacation and you're not, it to me it underscores how sort of miserable you are. And I just felt so bad for kind of both of them, because again, they immediately start squabbling. It's not even like fighting, just you can just tell they're kind of just talking past each other.
Yeah,
I mean, a bit.
It's really interesting, Rob, that you keyed into that, because that's something Kate and I talked about a lot in the inception of the film, was, you know, this idea of how much one's troubles can be magnified when you're in a beautiful place and you're expected to be having a good time. And, you know, from the outside world, it looks idyllic and perfect. And how could you not be having fun? And does that mean that you're, you know, a spoiled brat? Does that mean that you're depressed? Like that was part of what leads her to make this very out of character, very bold choice in kind of being pursued and pursuing this young man, is that she feels the guilt of being in a place where she feels that she should be having fun and she's not.
Yeah, I mean, it's Kate Bosworth in Italy, you know, what's not to be happy about? And yet, they're just not. And again, that's one of the things I liked about it, is that it's not Virginia Woolf, you know, where they're screaming at each other through the whole movie. It's, they're just not quite, like when she loses her wallet, and then they get into the discussion about the credit cards, and they're just, and you know, what does that mean? And it's just that kind of like, just that tension to it. And I didn't know that she and Itto Goldberg are old friends. And that's kind of amazing, because that was something else I wanted to ask about, is that like they have to have believable chemistry as a couple, but yet they have to not have so much chemistry that it's not believable. It's not unbelievable that they're having trouble. I mean, did she recommended him for the movie?
We lost Rob. We lost you.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you. You were saying you didn't know that Kate and Itto.
Oh, okay. I'll start over with that. Okay, sorry about that. So one of the things that I did not know about, and you just mentioned, is that Kate and Itto Goldberg are old friends. And I found that fascinating, because as, you know, in the movie, they have to have chemistry that they're a believable couple, but yet not so much chemistry that you've find it hard to believe that they're not getting along anymore. So did she bring him into the movie? Did she recommend him to you?
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, we wrote it after I met him, I wrote it for him. And what you said is so true, the tension. It was a lot about the banality of life, and how sometimes it's those little things like having to say your whole credit card number on the phone, or stubbing your toe, or, you know, losing your wallet. It's like that feels sometimes, especially if you're not in a good place, what life gets reduced to is just this series of banal moments, and how that can really leave you open to, you know, looking for something different.
Yeah, I mean, we have all seen movies with couples that aren't plausible. You know, you see the two actors that have been smooshed together and you're like, I don't buy these two as a couple at all. And you have to see these two as like, well, this is, yeah, I could see them together. But again, obviously that they're fighting, and he's obviously very distracted with his work. And I mean, the scene where after she has met Caleb for the first time, and then the next day she and Leonard are having like coffee outside, and then Caleb finds them, and clearly there's some flirtation going on here. I mean, Leonard doesn't necessarily know that, we know it, but the scene where he needs his phone number, and he, first of all, they share a cigarette together, which seems very intimate. Mm-hmm. And then he writes his phone number on her hand. Uh-huh. And you know, Leonard is just sort of watching this, and as a viewer, I'm like, what is with this guy? Can't he sense what's going on? And again, that seems like a really kind of knife's edge for him to have to walk, because he doesn't want to jump in too fast, but at the same time, this clearly seems a very strange thing for your wife to be doing with another man in front of you.
Well, I think what she's doing is trying to elicit some kind of emotion from him. You know, he's a little bit emotionless, and he seems to pour all of his feeling into his work and not into her. And so I think she's goading him a little. And we always talked about the idea that if he confronted her directly, if he blew up, she probably wouldn't go on to pursue her relationship with Caleb. But he is so measured and so afraid of getting into a fight that he kind of lets it happen, which makes her question, like, well, does he really love me? And what you're saying is exactly true. Like, she is kind of doing it on purpose. And so is, you know, Caleb's very young and probably isn't very calculated, but I think she wants her husband to show her that he loves her, and he doesn't. And I think, you know, one thing we talked about a lot when creating it was not having a villain. You know, so many times, especially in tales of infidelity, you have this kind of moral, you know, black and white. And in this story, it's a little more gray. It's like, who is at fault? Who, you know, who is the villain? There is no villain. It's just a bunch of people trying to live their lives. And, you know, the fact that Leonard has a career and a calling and a passion is something that Jane is missing in her life. It's something she's searching for by listening to those old tapes.
I was going to say, he certainly is, you know, even his character is, you know, at the beginning of their relationship, he was doing what he thought was a noble, correct thing to do when she had the miscarriage or when the baby died. He's stepping up, and he's like taking care of what he needs to take care of. And he's very practical that way. And that was a rough way for them to start their relationship. So it is kind of, it's just set off in a weird way.
When she first meets Caleb and she tells him what her husband does, and then he goes on that weird riff of all the jokes about what's the instrument that Leonard plays?
The viola.
And he's got all these viola jokes at the ready. And again, that's such a weird tension, because you would sort of think at some point she would kind of jump in and say, all right, knock it off, you know, because she's kind of insulting your husband. But yet she just kind of listens to it and slightly smiles a little. And you're like, okay. And so, yeah, she's trying to, I did want to mention to people who are not familiar with Itto Goldberg, his credits. He's been on TV shows like Snowpiercer, Get Shorty, Westworld, and a lot of people that listen to shows here on the network are big comic book people. He played the superhero Red Tornado on Supergirl from a couple of seasons ago, who was a robot. So it's kind of he's good at that kind of very dispassionate, cold sort of thing. And, you know, yeah, you want, you could tell that it's like Jane is just trying to get this guy to sort of care. The one point where she goes out all night, mm-hmm. and she comes home and he's like, you were out all night. And she just sort of says, yeah, I was out walking around. And he kind of is like, well, all right, I'm going to go back to work. I'm like, what? Like, mm-hmm. what are you talking about? Your wife was out all night and you couldn't get a hold of her. It seems like a cause for concern.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what's so cool about Itto is there's this dispassionate exterior and then so much going on underneath. And I think he's an artist, you know, he's a real artist, and classical musicians have a lot of passion. And I think that's what she's trying to get from him.
You mentioned the taste.
Yeah, he's so fun on set. He's so lovely.
Yeah, he's really, really charming and fun.
I mean, like, it is such a great group. Like, there's no way to do something like this without a great group of people who are all in it 100%.
Was it a fun shoot overall? Was the you said you were pregnant at the time as well?
I was so pregnant. I mean, that was part of it. It was funny. That was part of what made it happen so quickly after Life Happens. Is that, you know, I was pregnant and I knew, like, once I had the baby, it was going to be a long time till we got to make a movie. And we really wanted to ride that energy of, like, being inspired and wanting to work together. And so the project came together incredibly quickly, which is part of why we were happy with, you know, our $150,000, because we just wanted to make it immediately while we felt the creative spark, which is not something that you get to do a lot with film and television. You know, there's always a long period of getting a project together. So, you know, I credit my son with helping us really move this puppy along.
Yeah, the schedule was set, because at a certain point you can't fly.
Yeah.
At a certain point in your pregnancy. So we had to get it done before then.
And I definitely pushed those boundaries. By the time we left, I was gigantic. I gave birth like a month after we got back from Italy.
Oh my goodness. So, but I mean, you guys had a fun time. Like, it was, even though it was not a lot of money and not a lot of time, it was overall just a pleasurable experience shooting it.
It was amazing. I mean, like you said, we were in Ischia.
Yeah.
It was, you know, and we did have, because we had a lot of freedom and it was so unorthodox, we would shoot in the morning, take the afternoon, have like a long lunch, and then go back to shooting after lunch. And one of the locations, the little restaurant where they hang out, the orchard, you know, was this restaurant run by our friend Anthony's family that you could only get to by boat, where all the produce was grown there. The fish was caught from the sea. And so it was twofold. It was like a creatively exciting project, but also we were in Italy.
Wow.
And also in Italy in a way where we weren't tourists. We were really kind of exploring the place in a way you can only do when you work somewhere.
And we had access to a boat, and and it was like we ended up on that boat quite a bit.
Yeah.
And we have got these great group photos of us, everybody on the boat, just touring around the island looking for different locations to shoot, like the grotto and the lighthouse and all of that stuff. We just had these great vantage points out on the boat, but there was plenty of jumping in the water and eating fish right out of the back of the boat.
A lot of eating.
Yeah, and then sea urchins that were a bit of a problem at some point.
Yes, I got spiked by some sea urchins.
Yeah.
And it was really scary.
Glad Reese was there that day.
Yeah, my husband was there, and Doug was there, and our actor Jamie Blackley was there, and he looked like he was going to keel over at the spines in my leg, which was an amusing memory that I have of him.
So it was an adventure as much as it was a film set.
Yeah.
That sounds like an amazing experience. Just the word grotto kind of suggests a certain romanticism. That's not something people run into in their daily life, are grottos. But you just, the minute you just say, you're like, oh, that just sounds wonderful. I was near a grotto. That just sounds great.
Our sound mixer, that's a funny, when we were in the grotto, you know, Jamie and Kate were in there doing the scene. Doug had the camera in like a plastic bag.
Yeah.
I was standing there, you know, watching and directing. And then our sound recorder, Adam Catino, who also edited the film, had the sound equipment on a little float, like a baby's float. And he was just kind of floating around them with the boom mic in the grotto. So it was fun. It was really fun. And I'll tell you the Leonard Cohen story, because this is all. So as Doug reminded me, the whole premise was based on famous Blue Raincoat. And when we came to, you know, getting the music and scoring, our amazing composer, Matteo Messina, he just did such an incredible job with so little resources. He made it sound like a giant orchestra. And obviously that old world orchestral sound was very important to us because of the tone of the film, but also because one of our lead characters was a classical musician. And so he scored the whole thing. But I really, really wanted to have famous Blue Raincoat in the film, in the credits. But when we went to get the rights, it was $150,000. So it would have been the exact same budget as the whole film. And
I wondered, how are you going to afford that on $150,000?
Well, the financier said, no way, that would double our budget just for a song that plays in the credits. And so we had Matteo score something beautiful. And then I went to visit a friend who is a music producer, and he was in the studio with Adam Cohen, a musician in his own right, wonderful, talented guy who happens to be Leonard Cohen's son. And I happened to have a copy of the film, a DVD in my purse. And I said, look, this is probably not something you want to do. This is probably annoying, but I did write this movie kind of poetically inspired by your father's song, if there's any way you could get it to him. And he took it, and I never thought about it again. And then I got a call that Leonard had watched the film on a train and really loved it. And he ended up giving me the rights to famous Blue Raincoat. And it wasn't his voice, it was his backup singer, whose name I absolutely should know because she has the most beautiful voice. And it was so exciting because I got to have the song, but it was in a woman's voice, and it was so much better. It was so much more.
Oh, wow.
View of the film and her voice. We have to look it up. I have to say her name.
It also, it changed a familiar song, a song that was familiar, and it gave it just enough of a twist that made you listen to it a little more closely.
That's a remarkable happy accident.
Yeah, it really changed the dynamics of that song, and it changed the dynamics of how we did that sequence.
And I always was a huge Leonard Cohen fan, but boy, did that tip me over the edge to just be absolutely obsessed with him. Jennifer Warnes.
Okay.
She was a backup singer, and her version is just so stunning, and it's in the movie, which I'm very happy about.
That is amazing. Before I get off the cast, I do have to ask you about how did Claire Bloom playing the grandmother get involved? Because, I mean, Claire Bloom has been in Clash of the Titans, one of my favorite movies as a child, The Haunting, The King's Speech, The Illustrated Man, and Limelight. I mean, Kat, you're directing someone who's been directed by Charlie Chaplin.
I know. It was really exciting. I was as excited as I could possibly be. And she also was the same age as my grandmother, had really similar experiences in World War II. She was, you know, a young woman in World War II, just like my grandma. And I had a list of names. Oh, our wonderful casting director, I have to say, Leslie Wu, cast it. And she... She was amazing. She's the one who brought us Jamie Blackley, which was just a huge gift. And Leslie put together a list of women in that age. And I saw Claire Bloom, and like you, I knew her credits. I couldn't believe she would even consider it. But we sent her the pages, which, like I said, were very much based on my grandmother's real words and her real experiences in World War II. And Claire read it and said, oh my gosh, this really resonates with me. This is, you know, and often when you talk about World War II, it's the huge, heroic, grand, tragic stories. And you don't often hear, you know, people who lived through it, who were affected by it, but it wasn't monumental, catastrophic. Right. You know, the story my grandmother has of riding her bike home and she had to jump in a ditch because there were bombs overhead. And Claire really related to that. And it was so exciting because she changed some things. She infused it with her own voice. And I know my grandmother would have been just bowled over to have Claire Bloom voicing her. She, what did she say? She said when she got the pages, she's like, there's no way a young woman wrote this.
Wow.
And I said, no, it's true. Like, you know, 85% of those words are my grandmother's words. And she keyed right into that and saw the authenticity in it and, you know, signed up. And it was very, you know, it was easy. She was in a recording booth in London.
And was Kate there too? Or would they do them separately?
No, they did them separately.
Okay.
Yeah. We wanted to take up as little of Claire's time as possible. So, you know, she popped into a booth and just was a genius.
Yeah, that's amazing. I said, I've seen her in so many movies. As I was going through her filmography, I was like, oh Lord, it's this, you know, it's this one amazing movie after the next. So you mentioned earlier that the film was originally, you know, you originally showed it in black and white. And then I've read an article where you talked about that your distributor decided, you know, can sort of convince you to do it in color. For both of you, like, how do you decide, when you're shooting it, do you have that in mind of like, well, this has got to work in black and white as well as in color? I mean, how do you prepare for something like that?
I only shot it for black and white is what I did. So I never had any intention of it being seen in color. And it was, you know, I think I probably took it harder than anybody else. It was a very practical decision, I think, to also have it out there in color. But, you know, you kind of have to make a choice, I think, between those two things because of what all those tonalities really mean and what you're doing in black and white. So I always saw it as very much a black and white film, and that's how it was planned. And so when we, you know, and even things like the fact that his shirt is so bright yellow, mm-hmm. you know, the intention of that was to put him in a white shirt that we were going to tea stain. And then in the tea staining, it went awry. And so we were like, well, yellow will work just as well as the tea stain. And so there were some decisions that we made that were very much about keeping it black and white. But at the end of the day, it's a little bit of a different experience watching it in color. And I can't, you know, I've seen it obviously in both ways. We desaturated it quite a bit, and we went pretty warm and desaturated in the color version. But ultimately, I think I like it in the black and white because it sets this expectation of what you're watching at sort of a different place and a different level. Mm-hmm. You feel like maybe you're watching an older film, or you feel like you bring all that luggage with you, you know, of black and white films that you've seen, things like, I don't know, like Bicycle Thief, mm-hmm. or 400 Blows from film mm-hmm. school or something like that. You bring that with you, or Manhattan, and you feel like now I'm dropping into this film, and it does put the focus on the faces. And so I like it in that regard.
The director's cut is black and white on the right. DVD.
We pushed for it, and everybody was pretty supportive, but ultimately it became, you know, once you finish the film, you kind of have to hand it off to the people that put their money into it.
Well, also, you know, it's funny because right now black and white is kind of resurging, and there's all these films coming out in black and white. And there are periods where that happens. And we happen to be in a period where that was not cool. And you know, the distributors were just like, nobody's going to click on it. And I was kind of fighting it and really pushing for the black and white. And then one night I was laying on my couch, you know, flipping through movies. And I came to a black and white movie, and I thought, oh, I just don't have the energy to watch a black and white movie. And it kind of clicked. I said, oh, this is what they're talking about. You know, they're talking about streaming and people just wanting to watch something and tune out a little bit. And it was after that moment where I said, okay, look, I understand it from a business perspective, so let's do it. And then I, you know, it broke Doug's heart. He was very sad about it. We were able, though, to go back into the color, the DI, and kind of alter it to be a version of color that we ultimately did like. But it is a different experience for sure.
Is there a sort of qualitative difference in the way it would have been done on film, where you would shoot it on black and white film, but here you're not shooting it on black, you're shooting it in color and then you're changing it over to black and white? Isn't that the way it works now with digital?
Yeah, for the most part you probably still shoot in color, because what you want to gather as much information about the image that you're looking at, and so you want to gather all that information into the camera, and then I think most of those decisions should be made in post about what you can do with it. You give yourself a lot more flexibility. So I think even if I was to go back, I think I would still shoot it the exact same way in terms of shooting it in color and having that as the, because it made the black and white look better in that regard. And even if we were doing film, you know, with digital intermediates, I think I would still do a color film, because I think the technology of color film is outpaced some of the black and white. And the obviously the black and white is beautiful, but for what we were doing and for the fact that we were stealing everything and we weren't lighting everything, I think it was the way to go.
Gotcha. So Kat, I mean, you've been you keep busy. You've got a lot of credits for a relatively short period of time. And on top of all the movies you've done a lot of TV. You've done episodes of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Modern Family, Shameless, Dead Like Me. Is there for you as a director, is there a difference between bopping back and forth from film to TV? Is it all kind of the same experience, or do you find there is, you know, your muscles are a little bit different working in two different mediums?
You know, I'm a very collaborative filmmaker, so it wasn't, I didn't go from like doing films as an auteur to television where I felt creatively stifled. I always liked the collaboration. So television was a great next step for me. Television is incredibly collaborative in a way that I think sometimes film is perceived as not being, but I never approached film that way. I love collaborating, you know, with the producers, the cinematographers, the actors. So I would say it's not hugely different. You know, every show is different. Every show is a little universe unto itself. But in terms of the craft, it doesn't feel hugely different.
So you two have worked together on a lot of projects. You've already mentioned A Case of You and Departure Date. and now you're working on She-Hulk, which is amazing. Those are all incredibly different things. So can you both talk a little bit about your working relationship across these different projects?
We've also done a bunch of commercials together.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
We're still talking. We're still in and
speaking with each other. We're still friends. Yeah, you know, it's, I don't know. You find people that you really like and you want to keep working with them. I think that's something throughout my experience. You know, Lauren, the producer of While We Were Here, she's someone I still work with. Leslie Wu, the casting director, she cast Marry Me, my film that's coming out on Valentine's Day. When you find people who you share an aesthetic with, you share taste with, you get along with, you just want to keep working with them over and over, because that's really what makes this business fun, is you know, your creative collaborators. So I always find myself trying to, you know, gather together the people I like the most.
And there's a shorthand that you develop over the years with that we have together, and then there's things that I know that she does like and doesn't like. And so and you work a little bit different, and I've got a tremendous amount of trust in what Kat wants to do. And if she's coming to me with something that I'm like, I'm not seeing it yet, I know that I need to get on board and start to see it. And that's usually.
But it's also the back and forth. It's also, you know, I mean, I've developed a lot on the visual side over the years, but I come more from the story, you know, writing and acting. And so I love to work with cinematographers who have big ideas and can challenge me. And, you know, Doug is one of, you know, a couple people that I've worked with as a director of photography where I feel like, oh, they bring me big ideas. And it's exciting. When I worked on a show called Mozart in the Jungle, which is a show that I loved and was so excited to be working on, I called a dear friend of mine who's a classical cellist. And I said, I know what a conductor does. We all know what a conductor does. But explain to me from your point of view in the pit what a conductor does. And she said, well, you know, a conductor usually plays an instrument really well, but they try not to let that be the thing that everybody knows about. Some of them will even keep it a secret, like what their talent is, so that they can help all the people in the orchestra bring out their talent and be the best that they can be. And I said, oh my gosh, it's just like being a director. You want to gather the most talented people, people who are better than you at lots of things, and help them be the best that they can be, and bring out their talents and facilitate that. And so that's always something I love to do. You know, if I have an amazing costume designer, I don't want to dictate everything to them. I want them to bring their talent to me, and I help cultivate it and organize it.
And Doug, you feel like you can change your perspective on how you're seeing something should be shot depending on the project? Because obviously, you know, it's not like certain cinematographers that are like, you know, like Gordon Willis, you know, like you hired Gordon Willis to get a certain look at a certain point. But you're able to, again, when you're working across these different, something with as bright and open air as and While We Were Here, and then something is sort of, you know, directly comic booky and you know, eye popping as like, say, She-Hulk, as I'm guessing is going to be, you feel like you're coming to each project with like, okay, how does this work for this particular project, as opposed to having a preset idea of how you light things?
I think yeah, I mean, that's something that I think most cinematographers strive to do. It's like you have to have a lot of tools in your toolbox. And so sometimes it's just a different perspective. You know, I've phrased it before, like it's like you just put on a different hat. So there's certain hats that you wear when you're doing something that is, I don't know, that could be like very lifestyle. And then you put on a different hat if you're shooting a car chase scene, and then you put on a different hat. You know what I mean? So you kind of have these, you know, look, I love film and I love television and I love commercials and I love all these different visual medium, or not different visual mediums, but these different genres. And I can love and appreciate those things and have an understanding about how they're shot and kind of deliver that and deliver it in the proper way. I mean, just like, you know, a director can direct different genres. It doesn't seem, you know, cause you can love both those genres.
Well, and also it's like, there's sometimes a tendency to want to brand yourself. You know, I do comedy, I do this. And I think it's fun to challenge yourself and try different genres and experiment and play around.
Absolutely. So, well, before we wrap up here, I do want to ask you both one last question. And this isn't really even related to And While We Were Here. I just want to find out, because I love asking people this, what are some of your favorite films? Just either you think are the best films that you like, or just some of your personal favorites.
Marry Me. It's my favorite film right now.
I've
not seen it, but the trailer. It looks really good. I don't know. That's another thing, is it just depends on what mood I'm in. You know, it's like I could get really excited about 2001 and go and like want to go have that experience again in the theater and experience that. And I do get really excited about Luc Besson's early work. And the other day my son's getting old enough now where I feel like I can start showing him some of my old, like, classic films. And so I showed him 400 Blows the other day. And he loved it. He's like 12 years old and he's going through some things at school, and it really resonated with him. And he got to the end where he's running away from the military school, right? And like he escapes underneath the fence, and he runs out and he goes all the way out to the beach. And I'm like watching my son Simon out of the corner of my eye, and he gets to the end and it goes to that still frame. I was just trying to be as silent as I could. And he turned to me at the end of that and he's like, I think that was the best film I've ever seen. And so there's a lot of different things that you can pull from, a lot of different eras. And
it's true. I mean, I in terms of a favorite movie, I think it changes depending on the mood I'm in. And that's what I love about art. It's a reflection of where you are in the present moment. I mean, there are times where I would say my favorite movie is Step Brothers or the Brady Bunch movie. You know, there are times where it's The Sopranos, you know, the first season of The Sopranos. Sometimes it could be Sullivan's Travels by, Preston Sturges. There are so many different answers to that question. Oh, Raging Bull.
Yeah.
I love Raging Bull. I just rewatched Shawshank Redemption, and that movie is incredible. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a movie that really holds up.
I went back and started watching some Tarantino films recently, and he's amazing. I think I like watching films by director or by cinematographer. I just enjoy that exercise of watching somebody's career and somebody's work. And that seems to be a fun way to do things. And I can be a fan of a lot of different directors and a lot of different DPs.
The movie that got me into filmmaking was Mary Poppins. I watched it so many times as a little girl, and it's what made me want to be an actor. And, you know, then from being an actor, I went into directing, and it was really all due to Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke.
Did you ever do a musical?
Well, Marry Me is a musical. Marry Me has 13 new songs and full musical acts. And it's not a musical in the traditional sense where people bust out singing. But two of the lead characters are musicians, and we go to their concerts and we see full performances. So it is a musical.
This is the perfect opportunity for me to ask you, but what do you have coming up? Why don't you tell people, you're mentioning this movie, Marry Me. What are you two working on now?
Well, we didn't work on Marry Me together. That's why, right? Doug hasn't seen it. Mm-hmm. Marry Me is a Jennifer Lopez, Owen Wilson rom-com that comes out Valentine's Day of 2022. And I'm so excited.
And Florian Ballhaus shot it.
Florian Ballhaus, who is another frequent collaborator of mine, he shot it. And it was funny because I had a list that Florian was always on, because I love Marley and Me and I love The Devil Wears Prada. Another day, those would be my favorite movies.
Yes.
And so, yeah, that's what I've got coming up.
Doug, what about you?
Oh, I'm back to shooting. I do a lot of commercial work. And so I'm kind of back in that world right now. So there's a lot of little things coming up, a lot of quick little projects. And so we'll see what's out there on the horizon. I've been in talks on a couple of things, but nothing that I've nailed down as of right now. So I'm just kind of back to my commercial work.
Well, again, great. Thank you both for doing this. This is really fantastic. I said I had not heard of this film until I had a chance. I knew I was going to be talking to the two of you, and I really enjoyed it. Like I said, I watched it 3 times. I always love talking to people who make movies, and I love the stories. I love finding out the nuts and bolts of how it gets done. So I really appreciate you both coming on the show to talk with me about this movie.
I hope it was fun for you. It was certainly interesting to go back to talk about something that happened so long ago. You know, usually you're kind of right in the thick of it and you're just coming off of it. And so it's definitely interesting to have that perspective and to look back on it.
Okay, yeah, well, again,
back through all of our old photos. I'm like sitting here going through our behind the scene photos and our scout photos and all of this. And it's been a fun little ride.
Thank you very much for doing it. So, of course, everybody, if you want to find back episodes of the show, go to our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the Film and Water Podcast on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking movies over on Twitter at Film and Water Pod. If you like this show, check out my other movie-related podcasts, Fade Out, Superman Movie Minute, and Citizen Kane Minute, which just wrapped up a couple of weeks ago. And then finally, if you want to support the Find Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name-checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to my pal, Corey Musa, for his support of the Film and Water Podcast. Thanks so much, pal. So that is going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will see you later. But until then, that's a wrap.
Why don't you tell Leonard one of your Viola jokes? Come on.
So my aunt.
Come on. Let's hear one.
I have one. What is the definition of perfect pitch?
What?
When you throw a viola into the dumpster without hitting the rim.
You didn't just make that up.
I did?
It's too good.
I did.
Well, I'm impressed and I'm stealing it.